He asked how she was doing, and her response was, "I'm doing well. I'm doing fine. I'm the mom. I'm taking care of my first child. That's my expectation for myself." And without saying all those words, Canary Speech came back and said her depression levels are sky high.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Today, we visit the highly innovative and technology-based region of Provo, Utah. I'm truly delighted to host Henry O'Connell, CEO, President, and Founder of Canary Speech. Canary Speech is positioned at the forefront of AI healthcare innovation, harnessing the power of vocal biomarkers to transform disease detection, making significant strides in identifying conditions such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's through advanced speech and language analytics. Welcome, Henry, to the Business of AI in Healthcare.
Bob, thank you so much. It's a delight to be with you. Thank you for taking your time.
You too. I must start by saying this. I'm most impressed by what I've learned about Canary Speech in the past few weeks. When I first heard about what you're doing, it significantly captured my interest, and I'll share more about that later. But today, Henry, I want our audience to hear your story, how it got started, and the success that you've found worldwide with your team. And just to make sure our audience understands the mission, Canary Speech uses voice and speech to identify human condition and disease. How did you get started 8 years ago, Henry?
As you're saying, here in Provo, about 8 years ago, Jeff Adams and I met at a bagel shop. But the story started many years earlier than that, nearly 40 years earlier. At the time, I was at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. After graduate school, I was working in a neurology research group. Jeff Adams was at the NSA, and we happened to be in the same church group, and Jeff was sponsoring a party, and I went to the party, and we just hit it off. So our relationship began then. I went on to a career in business, working with Hewlett Packard and others along the way. And during the last 20 years, I've been doing corporate turnarounds where I would come in companies that were in the midst of change, either in distress or other change situations. And I would go in as an interim CEO. Jeff, when I met him, was, as I mentioned, working at the NSA. He was building mathematical models. He's a mathematician. He was building these mathematical models to de-encrypt spy messages, which I think is maybe one of the coolest jobs on earth, and he certainly thought it was. And I'm convinced he would still be there, but with the federal government, sometimes funding runs out. And so Jeff found himself up in the Boston area working with a gentleman named Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah.
And Ray, this is a brilliant man and an American inventor, created a number of different cutting-edge, never-before technologies. He was working at the time on developing natural language processing, speech detects that we have fluently across our industry and many industries today. But at the time, it didn't exist. And Ray, as brilliant as he is, had a different set of tools in his toolbox than Jeff did. And the work that Jeff had been doing at the NSA is fundamentally speech to text. It's the mathematical calculations that interpret a range of different elements, sublanguage elements, that allowed for an understanding of what was being spoken and creating a textual representation of that. And Jeff developed the first commercially available natural language processing tools. And with Ray, he went on to lead the team that built Dragon Naturally Speaking. Along the way, he did the same for legal dictation as Nuance is for clinical dictation, built some of the other fundamental tools that we think about. And about 15 years ago now, Amazon was looking for a team to build a brand new product. And they simply bought the company Jeff was in. they got 17 speech and language scientists, maybe the largest speech team in the world at the time. And they got Jeff Adams, who was leading that team, and Jeff O'Neill, who was a patent lawyer and a PhD in machine learning.
Wow.
All of them brilliant. That 19 individuals went on to form the foundation, the core that built the Amazon Echo 3 years later. It was supported by 254 initial patents that were prosecuted by Jeff O'Neill. Jeff Adams hired the largest ever assembled team of diverse group of technically diverse and otherwise diverse people to build Farfield Speech and the Amazon Echo. Just an exciting success. So when you look at the field, Jeff was responsible for so many of the critical elements that we appreciate today. So we're sitting in this bagel shop, and Jeff had finished up the effort on Amazon Echo and was talking to me about what he would do next. And he wanted to create this engineering firm that would take on otherwise impossible tasks in the field. Things that had not been done, things that weren't being done to the level they could be done, and to approach the advancement of field and speech. And I said to him, I said, Jeff, that's a wonderful thing to do. It'll be a great company. He did that, Cobalt Speech. I was with him in the initial months. But in that bagel shop at that time, knowing, I just had this great admiration and truly respect and love for this man. I said, someone like you, I have to ask, what's left at your table? What have you not done yet that you want to do? And we were older at the time, and so we had the opportunity to think in those terms. And he said, I've always wanted to apply speech and language to the analysis of human condition and disease. And this half hour, 45 minute, hour long luncheon turned into 8 hours. And we closed the bagel shop down in Provo on University Avenue. It still exists, but for the day we closed it down and we didn't eat them out. And I said to Jeff, what does the field look like right now? And he talked about the approaches, which had been textual. Foundationally, they were textual approaches. What words do people speak? What are their gaps? What are their filler words? How do you analyze that for specific diseases? And MIT had done some great work on mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease specifically by examining Agatha Christie's novels. She died with Alzheimer's disease, and they went back and looked at 40 years of novels as a textual representation of a data layer. And they could see where her sentence complexity and her word complexity began to shrink, and the size and length of her words were shrinking, and she was missing words she had used earlier. They could see all that from analysis and said, aha, here's that moment where Alzheimer's disease is starting. And then through the next few years, her future novels got less complex. But they had never created a functional tool that could work in a clinical environment. Most of us simply don't have 40 years of novels to bring into a clinic, and a clinic doesn't have the time it would take to analyze that. But foundationally, they demonstrated an association between disease, if you will, and speech, something that I think we all hear on a regular basis. And so that's where kind of the concept started. And after Jeff described this to me, you know how you have those aha moments sometimes. And I realized that as individuals, we do this all the time. It's called intuition, or it's called perception, or it's called a number of different things. But I said, Jeff, who knows my family well, obviously we have 40 years of friendship. And I said, my oldest daughter, Caitlin, when she would come home from school, when she was still living with us and from high school, she'd come home after soccer practice and she'd walk in. And I'm working at the kitchen table like we all do. And I look at her, and as she's walking across the room, I could tell from her gait, just how she's striding, that there's something up. And then when she would turn, I'd say hello, and she'd turn and look at me. I could tell from her facial and body language whether it was a good day or a bad day. And I do everything that every parent always does. And I get the same answer that every parent always gets, which I'd say, how was your day, honey? And she would say, it was fine, and continue to walk. And we all hear that. And we hear it from every, it's a universal fine. It doesn't matter what language. And I would say to her, honey, time out, give me some time here. And she would come back and we would start talking about it. And I said to Jeff, I said, Caitlin doesn't live with us anymore. She's married. She has her first child. And not my best day. I would have her here still, but that's not what we get. And as parents, our job is to help them get out of the house, not keep them in the house. So I would call her, and I admit that I call her at least twice a week, not twice a day, but at least twice a week. And I said, within moments of that conversation starting, and it has nothing to do with the words she is speaking, and it's irritatingly accurate, and it's the same for all of us, all our parents. I said, I know if it's a good day or a bad day, and I know if she's happy or sad or anxious or upset. And I'll say to her, honey, what's up? And then we get to talk about it. And I said to Jeff, telling this story to him, I said, that's what clinicians are, and nurses are doing every day. And it has nothing to do with the words people are speaking. How are we doing that? And he said, I don't know. And I said, we ought to find that out. And if you want to build something that addresses human condition and disease, why don't we do that? And that became Canary Speech in that bagel shop. Now, we didn't have that name yet. Got the name later. In fact, my middle daughter is the one that came up with the name, and then she drew the logo. And when we got the patent on the logo, we got it in her name, which I just thought was cool. So she has a registered trademark in the patent office. She signed it over to the company, but it was cool.
I was curious how you came up with the name Canary Speech. I knew there's always a story behind that. So it was your daughter that evolved that name.
It is. And it all relates to canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
It's an early warning system.
Quick note from our sponsor, WillCall. WillCall is a hands-free, voice-activated call system used today in care facilities across the country, with a home version rolling out in a limited early access phase. It supports people who can't use traditional nurse call buttons. With conditions like ALS, spinal cord injuries, stroke recovery, or advanced Parkinson's. Learn more at willcallnurse.com. Back to the episode.
Let's talk more about that. So you've got these non-word elements of speech that you're talking about, and somehow you were able to start down the path of finding biomarkers that are related. So how do you establish the fact that something's a biomarker and it's valid?
Well, it's very interesting. I haven't told this story before because it's internal, but I'll mention it. So in order to create a textual representation of the speech to text, there are sublanguage elements. And for many years, we know about those. There are jitter and many other things, but there's many of them. Today, we've identified 2,590. When we started the company, there were 2,554 that we had identified. But we didn't identify. Those were elements of how the vocal cords function and derivatives of the vocal cord functionality. So how rapidly are they vibrating? How quickly and tightly is the musculature around them? So it's raising tonal elements or declining tonal elements. When we get excited, our tonal elements go up and the speed of our speech naturally goes up. And so when we got the company started, we knew that this group of elements existed because Jeff had been working with them for years in the development of natural language processing, in the development of far-field speech. So a lot of the work had been done on that, but once the tools for NLP had been developed, the major institutions saw those as great tools to create a data set. But the data set was a textual representation of what we were speaking, rather than a representation of the elements of how that happens. So years after that initial development, work, people began recognizing that the central nervous system is controlling the vibrational characteristics of the vocal cords. Mm-hmm. So in essence, the ones and zeros of the central nervous system, the electrical impulses, are controlling the musculature that's controlling the vibrational characteristics. So speech is directly connected through this representation of this primary data layer to the central nervous system. So in essence, like the gene in the alleles of the genome are directly connected to traits. These electrical impulses controlling the vibrational characteristics or other elements of the articulatory system, the tongue, the cheeks, the movement, the respiratory, the power of our respiration, the speed, everything about it, all coordinated subconsciously to create every language in the world, is all driven by the central nervous system. So this primary layer of data becomes characteristically understood to be a biomarker. A biomarker is not a word. A word isn't the same across populations or across languages. But these characteristics of the vocal cords are. And so if you define a biomarker as something that is constant across populations, for instance, with the genome, if you have the alleles in your genome for green eyes, as I do, and in fact, I have green-blue eyes, they move back and forth, that set of alleles, a complex set of code, characterizes what my eyes are. And it doesn't matter where you were born in the world. So that's a biomarker.
Got it.
They're not biomarkers. They're obviously not biomarkers. There's a different word for everything. There are similar, like in dramatic languages, there are similar derivatives, but they're not the same words. And if you go from English to Japanese or even English to Hungarian, for instance, which is a completely different language, words are not biomarkers, but they are created by these same 2500 M90 features.
So what I'm hearing here, Henry, is that language and disease, they're attached. They're actually attached.
They're attached because if the central nervous system is either impacted by a disease directly, meaning there is damage like MCI or mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's or Huntington's or Parkinson's or other progressive neurological diseases are damaging the nervous system, MS, for instance, another one, all of those damage the central nervous system. The central nervous system is the conductor of the orchestra for language. And so if the central nervous system is damaged, then language is going to be a witness of that damage. It's going to have markers within it. What the central nervous system does is it tries its best to keep language fluent and accurate through this disease process. For instance, Parkinson's have what is called the Parkinson's draw. There are many other damages to their language, but there's a Parkinson's draw where language and words stretch out because the musculature around the vocal cords gets weakened and it takes them longer to create it. In mild cognitive impairment, people have longer pauses. They have impacts on their language. While they're still trying to keep it fluent and accurate, there's impacts on it. So we're looking for those impacts, and the central nervous system is trying to keep it as accurate as possible, but it's taking different pathways to get there. All of that's the evidence of a disease.
Okay. So it seems like there's a similar metaphor or analogy as the retina is a place where people look to find all types of things. Retinopathy. I've interviewed people talking about how they're using retinopathy to look at other areas of disease. And mm-hmm. You have found a way to use voice and speech to really go down that path. So I'm understanding the technology. You guys have advanced that. You started off finding out that's what you wanted to be passionate about. And so you focused on that and you've derived some information and tools. Tell us more about how this works in the real world, what type of results you've been getting, and why it works, how it's making progress.
We were fortunate that in that bagel shop, the decision was that this would be a medical product. It would be within the medical framework. That's a very different thing than creating a wellness product. the requirements are higher, the demands are higher, the security is higher, all of those things. And you learn things along the way. Not everything in those 6 or 8 hours of conversation came out. But we made the decision we would seek to do human condition and disease. That's very important because it drove everything. So the product as it is today is a platform. As Jeff had done so many times in the past, we weren't trying to chase a single disease. Because when you go to an institution, a healthcare institution, Harvard or Beth Israel or Hackensack Meridian, Intermountain Healthcare, whatever they are, they're not treating a single disease. You may be working with a neurology group that specializes in Parkinson's, or you might be working with a group in behavioral health or somewhere else, but generally they're treating a spectrum of illnesses. And we decided in the bagel shop, we would create a platform of capabilities that would be able to address a broad range of different diseases. In fact, today we have 23 issued patents worldwide on what we're doing, and 16 pending. As Jeff had done in the past, and to some degree I had also done in the past, we were creating new technology. And so this platform today focuses on interfacing with the clinician and the patient in a non-invasive and non-intrusive way. And Canary Ambient Listening, using real-time streaming and real-time, near real-time data analysis and score returning, all is part of that. So what we do today is we listen to a conversation. We don't ask them for a sample. It's all based on natural speaking, conversational speaking. The entire field prior to us had been based on principles that came out of speech pathology. And for 25 years, they adopted what had been good processes and good approaches by speech pathology to the detriment of developing tools for analysis. Speech pathology is fantastic, but they give you a paragraph to read because they're trying to identify a specific deficit. You can't say CHs or you can't say SHs or you have trouble with Ts at the end of words, whatever it is. They're trying to identify that. So they challenge you through this paragraph with that. The problem with that is that we use a different part of our brain to read than we do in conversation. Evidence of that is political speak from a teleprompter. People can scream at a teleprompter and still not construct an independent sentence. And because we use a different function of our brain. The same is true of singing. Music is a different element, and people with advanced Alzheimer's can still sing songs they've known for years, and that's such a wonderful thing for them. So we abandoned that. We went to conversational speech, but that took us a couple of years because the major scientists that we had were trained in institutions where they were trained to use certain processes, certain patterns, certain norms. And finally, we had this day of awakening where we sat down our speech and language scientists and said, 25 years of failure should not be the pattern for success. And by failure, I don't mean that they weren't contributing. I just mean that they hadn't produced a single product in the clinical field that was practical and could be used by a clinician for the analysis of human condition and disease, not one. So I said, We have to think of the proverbial, we got to go outside this box.
Yeah.
So our product today is a decision. That was a decision point in the company. The first time I said, I think we could patent something 7 years ago, 2016, I'm talking with our senior scientists and I had been reading existing patents, MIT's and Carnegie Mellon's and Cambridge's and everybody's. And I said, we're not doing what they're doing. I think we could patent what we're doing. And my chief scientist said, nope, we can't. I said, no, I think we can. And he said again, nope, we can't. And I was talking to Jeff after that, because he's now running Cobalt. And I told him that story. And he said, why don't we talk to Jeff O'Neill? Remember the guy who published 254 patents for Amazon in 3 years in speech and language, and who's brilliant. And so I talked to Jeff O'Neill and he said, why don't you and your chief scientist both present to me? And at the end of that presentation, Jeff O'Neill just simply said, I think Henry's right. And what do we have to lose? So that's 23 patents later, and that chief scientist isn't with us any longer. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But he's also on 9 patents, are some of our fundamental patents. And you really have to go outside that box. And so what we ended up doing was we developed an entire platform. So if we're speaking, if we're listening to a conversation ambiently with a doctor and a patient, we're capturing real-time, streaming real-time, 40 seconds of conversational speech. We're doing diarization. We're separating their voices. We're doing speaker identification. We're doing sample quality AI stuff. What's the signal to noise? This is a good sample. That information is being captured in 25 millisecond windows with a 10 millisecond slide. So we functionally have 2,590 features being captured every 10 milliseconds. And from your prior work, this kind of streaming gives you a very large data set. We have over 15 million elements every 45 seconds or so.
Wow.
Machine learning loves that.
Yeah, of course.
So we're doing feature extraction. The feature extraction capabilities is some proprietary feature extraction and some commercially available, but we stack 5 feature extractors. And the order in which we extract experimentally produces different data sets slightly and different data results. And there are multiple different models which we can process through that are commercially available. Which ones we use are determined by clinical trials with teams of medical neurologists, behavioral, and otherwise specialists in the field. So we never develop anything outside of a clinical relationship with a principal investigator and a clinical team and an IRB review. And we do that all within clinical environments. And then we take that data set and the diagnosis done by that expert team, and we create a machine-driven, AI-driven algorithm that correlates to the expert team.
Wow. Let me ask you a question here, Gary. The amount of work and development that takes place here, ultimately, you end up having some type of augmented relationship with the physician. What are the results of what you've described here? What can you actually say is valid? This is the ground truth of what's working. How do you verify all that you talked about from a technology perspective to actual use in a clinical environment?
Great question. And often great questions have simple answers. And this one does. In that bagel shop, we decided that we wanted to be a tool in the hand of the clinician, something that when they were observing human conditions and disease through conversation, not through the words that were being spoken, but the observation, their expertise, their knowledge, the number of times they've either been with this patient or similar patients, tens of thousands of times, their training, their education, their own intuition, what we call intuition, I think is their machine learning tool, their brain. We wanted to be a tool in their hand that would objectively validate what they were observing.
Okay.
So the ground truth needed to be them. So we didn't use Facebook or Craigslist to collect data. It's a disconnect. And you can't create a clinical product from that. You really had to get your ground truth from a group of experts in the field of neurology on Parkinson's, or in the field of behavioral health, psychiatrists for Alzheimer's disease. We're currently working with a group at Hackensack Meridian on autism and ADHD. You wouldn't go outside of that for your ground truth, because that's the standard in the world right now. So we took the standard in the world as the ground truth, and then advanced AI and machine learning to create an algorithm that could be an objective component. It wouldn't matter whose hand it was in, but it could objectively measure what experts had measured in the field. So that was the ground truth.
And so you're not really providing a definitive diagnosis then? You're really providing an assessment that the clinician, the doctor can work with?
So what we're doing is we are providing a clinical decision support assessment, but an objective one. If you do a GAD-7 or a PHQ-9, which is the anxiety and depression test sets, GAD-7, 7 questions, PHQ-9, 9 questions, that's right. A subjective measurement, self-assessed. So a person is doing that. People are motivated differently. For instance, I'm an older human being today. When someone asks me if I'm having a good day or a bad day, or to answer a bunch of questions that reflect that, my reference point is my dad crawling around on the ground in Italy during World War II.
Yes.
I have a different perspective than the next person in the door, but our central nervous systems are identical. So how our central nervous systems are functioning and what the expert team has evaluated based on their experience, if I could make that an objective thing, we provide that objective information among an array of information for the clinician to validate the diagnosis that they are making. But we're a clinical decision support for that. We're not an endpoint for it.
So how have you done with working with dementia and Alzheimer's? What type of results are you finding? What kind of confirmation are you getting from your ambient speech recognition and voice recognition?
So progressive neurological diseases in general are so entwined with the central nervous system, and we're measuring things that are directly controlled by the central nervous system, that correlations are 98-99%. False positives, less than 1%. False negatives, less than 1%. I'm 40 seconds of speech. That's a very powerful objective tool for a clinician. In behavioral health, the ground truths are a little more flexible. It's a much more complex issue. There are chemical factors involved, central nervous system. There's so many different things. My son is an MD, and he's a psychiatrist. So medical degree, and then his residency at Emory in that specialty. And we speak every day almost about different diseases, about the complexity of behavioral health. In that case, we're about 80%, 84% accurate. But referrals at the primary care level are only about 15% accurate. So it's a good objective addition to the information they have. And then things like ADHD and autism, PTSD as a specialty within behavioral health, or postpartum depression as a specialty within behavioral health, anxiety, depression being core to that area. Those things all have different levels of accuracy, but machine learning is wonderful in that the more experience it gets, the more accurate it gets, but it's never going to exceed the ground truth. So the ground truth, which is a clinical team's assessment, and canary speech, which is an objective measurement of these biomarkers, are companions to each other. There's another thing we should talk about, because we're now working with large language models and multimodal approaches. So there are other things that are impacting on the core 2,590 features by doing multimodal, adding in gait analysis, adding in visual analysis and facial analysis, or a range of other biomarkers into the algorithms that measure this.
So how do you get the healthcare world, the physicians and others, to adopt and believe and trust in what you're doing, augmenting what they do as professionals? How do you go about getting that type of acceptance? Because I would think, Henry, with these type of results and this type of technology, that you're sitting here, it's like you got the cure for polio. It ought to be FedExed out to everybody. It shouldn't be sent on a slow train down the road. People should be jumping all over this. Are you finding that type of reception, or is there resistance?
We're multiple years into what we're doing. 5, 6, 7 years ago, when we were talking to people about what we were doing, we weren't as far along. We didn't have all the pieces together. This is more than just the algorithms we build. It's also the security system, which is high trust and ISO certified, HIPAA compliant, everything you can imagine. We function at the same security and ethical standards that a hospital does, Canary Speech does. So we're a good partner there. having partnerships like we do with Microsoft being embedded into the Dragon Copilot. So you can imagine if you can be a product that's non-intrusive in their workflow, that makes it easier. It turns out that there are about 14 CPT codes that reimburse for what we do also.
Oh, wow.
So that's helpful too. So they actually, instead of setting a patient aside and having them do survey-based type of analysis, instead of having them do that, which are subjected in nature anyway, just as part of the natural flow, we fit into that process and we provide that information while they're still with their patient. And it's objective. And it has CPT code reimbursement, which flows through the system. So a Dragon Copilot or a Zoom platform or a Teams platform, Canary Speech is integrated into those seamlessly, functioning in the background with ambient listening under the same security and patient compliance and the ethical standards that you would expect in a hospital. We're all compliant with that. And there's an informed consent. And this is just fluently happening. So now it's rolling out with a lot of hospitals. But Dragon Copilot, the DAX new product, is capturing this audio anyway.
Yes.
And they're doing speech to text for clinical and patient notes very accurately now. That same audio now has the enhancement of having Canary speech analysis for a whole range of different diseases. So the doctor is seeing this in real time. An example, we are working with Kentucky Baptist, rolling out the Dragon Copilot product. And one of the doctors was reporting on a patient they had. And it's a primary care doctor, because we're functioning in the primary care area, developing in the specialty area, deploying in primary care. And this primary care doctor is meeting with a young woman who 6 weeks earlier had delivered her first child. He's known her for a long time. And he asked a question, a lot of questions about her baby. And he asked how she was doing. And her response was, "I'm doing well. I'm doing fine. Stiff upper lip. I'm the mom. I'm taking care of my first child. That's my expectation for myself." And without saying all those words, Canary Speech came back and said her depression levels are sky high.
Wow.
And the doctor said it was game changer. It allowed him to explore that further with her. And she was suffering deeply from depression, postpartum depression, but wanted to be the good mother.
But he have found that out without the Canary speech?
No, because if she took a GAD-7 or a PHQ-9, she would have responded the same way on those. It's my job is not to be depressed. My job is to meet mom.
Yeah.
God bless our mothers. That burden is on all of their backs. And my dad died when I was young. And my mom still had 5 kids at home. I'm a very light sleeper. I don't remember my mom going to sleep without crying. Our mothers do that all the time. And so when they're filling out a subjective question set, their mindset is, I've got to be the good mother. Sometimes being the good mother also means understanding that this load is nearly breaking your back. Let others help. So Canary speech doesn't listen to the words they're saying. They could be saying, I'm having a great day. Everything is going fine. It's so wonderful to be a mom. And what we're reading is the central nervous system's, the characteristics of elevated depression.
Besides looking at audio to text translation, you're looking at a different set of data, a more complex set of data that really represent things. Henry, you mentioned relationships. What have you done or are you doing with universities around the world?
Oh, it's so much. We currently have 16 ongoing developments. We sponsor graduate students at different universities in Ireland at Tala Hospital. We did work with them and we did work up at Ulster Hospital. A PhD candidate published his work that we funded, just providing, using a cell phone, remote connections with the Ulster Hospital team, being able to analyze for behavioral health and other elements that may be health conditions that could be addressed. And we're working in Japan, different parts of Europe and the US extensively with university medical groups primarily and clinical teams, as I mentioned earlier. So this is work that's ongoing across a range of different diseases that are being added. We'll add 12 new diseases. We currently analyze for about 12 diseases in progressive neurological diseases, behavioral health, cognitive health, which is a progressive disease, MCI and Alzheimer's. And then we're adding childhood illnesses this year. And we're working in various parts of the world with teams doing that.
It sounds like you're in the early innings of the ball game here, that you're far from completing this whole path that you started on with Jeff. I know you've raised significant money. I'm sure you've got big plans for the company. I wouldn't be surprised if you ultimately get acquired by a Microsoft or go public. Who knows what the end point is. But my question for you is, will you ever complete this, or will it be something else after this? Because you and Jeff sat in the bagel shop 8 years ago as older guys going, we're not through yet. And so what's your mindset here? You're not through yet, are you?
No. And when you think about the ability to capture the complex data set, if you will, of a voice, it's done on smartphones anywhere in the world. My position has always been, and it really ties back to growing up in poverty and how many people helped us. My position has always been, it shouldn't matter where you are in the world. We should be able to get good healthcare.
Yes.
And that enables individuals to have that, and food, of course, enables them to realize the potential of their lives. And so good healthcare it could originate at a Hackensack Meridian, providing healthcare to rural areas of America through video conferencing or telephone conferencing. But if they can have objective information, and in video conferencing, it'll expand even broader to a range of different diseases. Think about blood profiles that we do today. We will have entire voice profiles that'll be collected in near real time and available to the clinician or the clinical team while they're assessing a patient, and it won't matter where they are in the world. And it shouldn't. That's basic healthcare for them. And then you consider the kinds of things, the complexity, the density of capturing that information through the satellite structures that we have. It's just amazing. There are a number of organizations, large health organizations, that are looking at putting kiosks in different places of the world. You could do that, but you could begin by just using the cell phone they have in their hand.
Yeah. It's an incredible time we're living, and things are moving exponentially, and we as human beings, we don't operate that way. We're a little bit slower. But Henry, I'm delighted to have this time with you. We'll run out of time. We could go on for another bagel shop 6 hours. I'm sure we could. But this has been a really exciting time for me to learn, and our audience to learn, about these advancements that are taking place. All this data, all this research, it could have just been part of history, but you guys decided to uncover it, go deeper into it, and really find the true value that was hidden in it. And I think that's a remarkable story. They should make a movie about this. Very well done. So thank you for being on today.
I appreciate it very much, and thank you for taking the time again.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.